It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The fate of an agreement between UPMC and Highmark is back in Commonwealth Court. Pretty soon, Highmark insurance customers will no longer have access to UPMC doctors at in-network rates unless the courts extend the consent decree by June 30th. In studio is WESA's health reporter, Sarah Bowden. Welcome back to the program, Sarah.
Hey, Kevin.
Sarah, 2 weeks ago, you were in Harrisburg when the High Court heard the oral arguments on whether to extend that soon-to-expire five-year agreement. What specifically did the court decide yesterday?
The court decided yesterday that the language of the provision that they were looking at was just so vague and they needed more evidence. So they kicked it back down to Commonwealth Court to ask that court to gather more evidence, which means that both sides will be presenting more, I guess, extensive arguments on what that provision meant.
And it was a 4-3 ruling, not along party lines.
Nope.
Justice David Wecht wrote the majority opinion. At the heart of it, what was he saying?
Wecht basically said that the provision is subject to more than one reasonable interpretation. And to be clear, this provision said that it was open to some interpretation or some modifications. And the question is, what is a modification versus a really significant change? And he says, although the applicable termination date is near, the question he's asking is very narrow. And he thinks that the Commonwealth Court can get this work done within the time allotted.
Now, Justice Max Baer wrote the dissent. He argued, in a sense, this is really just Attorney General Josh Shapiro maybe overreaching?
Yeah. He says that an attempt to seek judicial intervention to eliminate the termination date and improve upon UPMC's permanent injunction basically is trying to get UPMC to remain tethered to Highmark in perpetuity.
So force them to continue on this agreement that they won't want to be a part of
that's
anymore.
That's the normal person way to say it, exactly.
Okay. So what could change now that it moves back to lower court?
Well, I think what we're going to see is just some more extensive arguments. Whatever the lower court decides will probably get appealed back to the Supreme Court. I think really what we're seeing is just a lot more waiting.
All right. So decision comes, too much vagueness in this, need more evidence. Who's claiming victory after that 4-3 decision yesterday?
Everybody's claiming victory. The Attorney General's claiming victory. UPMC's claiming victory. Really, it's just kicking the can down the road. And if there is a winner or a loser, I think the loser might be patients who still don't know what's going to happen with their health care.
And in the meantime, what are they having to do? Because June 30th is not that far away. What are the patients having to do right now?
Well, the patients, UPMC says patients should be finding new providers. They've known this is happening for a while. A lot of patients have some really complex medical conditions and have been working with their medical teams for very many, many years. And they're saying, like, that's just a horrible solution. And it will really compromise my health and my well-being.
And we don't like to, a lot of people don't like to change doctors.
No, period. It's a pain.
Mm-hmm. So. All right. So you mentioned, I mean, we only have 4.5 weeks left and the High Court said, Commonwealth Court, you've got to hold this hearing and make a ruling by June 30th, right?
I think they didn't set a date, but they said that, you know, this is a very narrow question about whether or not the termination date can be modified or extended. And since it's such a narrow question, there should be enough time for the Commonwealth Court to get this done.
So narrow, get the argument done, but it's then going to probably, as you say, wind up back in Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, patients maybe have their fingers crossed, waiting what?
I mean, I've been talking to patients for months, and they seem upset, anxious, nervous. I mean, it's just, I think it's not good for them.
Sarah Bowden is WESA's health reporter. Thanks so much for joining us today, Sarah.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Are our youngest residents of this region at greater risk of getting cancer because of the air they breathe? Pittsburgh might no longer be the smoky city it once was, but pollution from industrial sources is still having an effect on health in many surrounding counties in western Pennsylvania, specifically when it comes to childhood cancer. A recent analysis from Environmental Health Network found kids in Allegheny County are exposed to extremely high levels of carcinogenic chemicals, particularly those in emissions coming from coke ovens. The analysis found that children in our region face much higher rates of cancer than kids in most of the United States. Christina Marusik is a reporter for Environmental Health News. She spoke recently with The Confluence's Megan Harris.
Christina, when did the issue of childhood cancer, especially these types, come to your attention?
So I've been looking into air pollution in the region for about a year. Last summer, I wrote about childhood asthma rates here. So I started looking into cancer. And one part of the conversation that seemed to be missing was what the impacts of the air pollution we have here on children. I saw a lot of reporting on cancer rates in general, but very little about what the types of air pollution we see here in the Pittsburgh region do to kids who live here.
Exactly how much more at risk are children in Allegheny County of getting cancers?
It's a little difficult to quantify. So there's an important difference between risk and rate. Rates of cancer describe the number of people who have cancer. Risk is determined by looking at the quantity and quality of air pollution emissions and using statistical analysis to determine how many people are likely to get sick as a result. The mechanism for environmental causes of childhood cancer is still sort of unknown in the science world, or it's still sort of emerging, but we do know that we have higher quantities of carcinogenic air pollution emissions here in Allegheny County than in much of the rest of the country, specifically from coke ovens.
And you recently crunched some numbers from the EPA's most recent National Air Toxics Assessment data?
That's right. I looked at the 2014 data set, which is the most recent set available. They release those every 3 to 5 years. The data is publicly available, but it's a lot to get through. It's a huge data set. So coke oven emissions are a mixture of chemicals that includes things like formaldehyde, cadmium, and arsenic, all of which have been linked to cancer. And studies of coke oven workers have reported an increase in cancer of things like the lung, trachea, bronchus, kidney, prostate, other types of cancers. So as a result, the EPA has classified coke oven emissions as what they call a group A known human carcinogen, and they rank those all the way from A to E. A is a known carcinogen and E is not likely to be carcinogenic. So coke oven emissions aren't one chemical. They're a mixture of a bunch of stuff, but there's enough cancer-causing stuff in them that EPA rates them as A, a known human carcinogen. We have the largest coke plant in the nation here at U.S. Steel's Clairton Coke Works, and it's not operating cleanly. So they've been fined for thousands of clean air violations over the years.
And been in the news pretty consistently since a Christmas Eve fire and one of the coke ovens.
Exactly. And that fire caused an increase in both particulate matter pollution and sulfur dioxide pollution. But before that, they had a long history of breaking the law when it comes to clean air as well. And just in the last year, the local health department has fined them $2.6 million for air violations.
So with all of these emissions and the increased risk just generally, why do you think children are more specifically at risk?
So children's bodies are more vulnerable to the effects of pollution than adults' bodies. They breathe about 4 times as much air as adults, and their complex systems in their bodies, like their reproductive systems, their immune systems, their brains, are still in the process of developing. So they're less able to get rid of toxics that get in. They just don't have the tools yet to flush those out in the same way that an adult's body has. And if those processes are interrupted, it can cause serious developmental problems and also can cause gene mutations that can lead to cancer.
Were you able to talk to any patients in the course of your reporting?
I did. I talked to several cancer survivors. Mm-hmm. So no one who was currently undergoing treatment, but I talked to a number of parents who had had kids who had undergone treatment for cancer at Children's Hospital here in Pittsburgh. One was Kristen DeLuca, whose daughter Madalena DeLuca had cancer when she was just 2 years old. And she is now 5 and a happy, healthy kindergarten student. But the experience obviously was really difficult for their family. And Kristen told me that she has long wondered whether pollution in the region could have played a role. And for parents of kids with cancer, it's really hard to get answers to those types of questions.
You mentioned you've talked to a lot of survivors. Does that mean that the prognosis for some of these childhood cancers, at least, is not the worst case scenario for an already, you know, challenging diagnosis?
Yeah, the good news is that we have gotten much better at treating childhood cancers. The survival rate for childhood leukemia, which is the most common childhood cancer, is about 85%. Brain cancer is the second most common childhood cancer, and it has a similarly high survival rate. So we do have lots and lots of survivors living in this country. I spoke with a pediatric oncologist at Children's Hospital, Dr. Erica Freeling, who pointed out that survivorship is difficult, that kids have lifelong health risks after they survive, that they may face things like heart issues or developmental problems or infertility as they get older, and they have to be regularly monitored. That could be from the chemotherapy, from the treatment itself, from the cancer, from a combination of the two. But survivorship is difficult.
There's been some evidence that the increase in childhood cancers in Allegheny County might mirror a national increase in childhood cancer, which is up about 40% since 1970. Do researchers have a consensus on why we're seeing an increase overall?
The short answer is there's not a universal consensus among researchers. A number of prominent epidemiologists, some of whom I interviewed for this story, do feel that there has to be an environmental factor. And environment, broadly defined, can include changes in lifestyle and diet. It can also include things like chemical exposures and air pollution.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm in studio with Christina Marusik, a reporter with the Environmental Health News, who's been covering childhood cancers and their prevalence, especially in relation to air pollution in the Pittsburgh region. We've been talking a lot about childhood cancer. What about pregnant and nursing mothers? How might this kind of pollution affect them?
So the science on this is also still emerging, but there's some evidence to suggest that exposures that mothers have while they're pregnant, and actually that both parents have even prior to conception, can increase the risk their future child faces for developing certain diseases, and that includes some types of cancer. Again, the research is still emerging. There's not a clear path, but one researcher, he described cancer risk as being like a pie chart. And in one piece of the pie, there might be your genetics. And in another piece, there might be, you know, if your parents were exposing you to secondhand smoke. And then the third piece might be exposure to carcinogens and air pollution. If any one of those pieces of the pie goes missing, cancer won't occur. So if the air pollution doesn't occur in people who have those particular slices, we all have different pies, then their cancer won't happen. So from a public health perspective, it's a way to remove a lot of risk from a large population of people at once.
Pittsburgh, of course, is now attracting a wide swath of newcomers, especially folks coming in to work in education and robotics or the medical field. Is there a difference in how pollution might affect someone relatively new in town versus a lifetime resident?
So most of the risk assessments we've seen here are in regard to lifetime risk. So it's hard to break that down into how your risk changes if you've been here for 1 year or 5 years. But we are really good at calculating with the tools that we have available what someone's lifetime risk is if they're exposed to this level of pollution over the course of their lifetime.
Do you think Pittsburghers and residents of Western Pennsylvania generally are aware of their increased cancer risk?
I think that awareness is growing. I think more and more people are concerned about this and are speaking up and urging public officials to take action. And we've also seen people asking U.S. Steel pretty directly to do what they can to clean up their operations.
Did they provide any response to you directly?
They have not responded to my request for comment.
So what does all this cancer risk mean for healthcare providers in the region?
That's a big question. In January, a group of experts on childhood cancer and environmental exposures from across the country actually came to Pittsburgh to discuss with oncologists and medical providers here what they can do to address the question of environmental exposures and cancer risk. And some physicians expressed a little bit of discomfort. It's often not something that doctors are asked to do. It may be something they've actively been discouraged from doing. They certainly don't want to cause their patients alarm or make them feel like they need to move to protect their families. But at the same time, physicians can play a role in all of this. Part of that is just becoming educated about the risk of environmental exposures and letting their patients know what steps they can take to keep the air in their house cleaner, to minimize their exposure in other ways through, you know, food or personal care products to potentially cancer-causing ingredients. But mostly right now, I think for practitioners, the important thing is educating themselves and learning how they can talk to their patients about this.
That speaks quite a bit to treatment and even preventative care. But it seems like maybe doctors have been engaging more in the public about these issues in recent years. Do you have any idea what measures they might be most interested in? What kinds of solutions?
The physicians I've spoken with have really expressed an interest in a public health solution to this problem. So, you know, they can talk to their patients one-on-one about minimizing their exposures, but ultimately we can make the biggest difference and cause the most reduction in risk for the whole region if we clean up the air. So physicians have started advocating for measures like that. They've started wading into politics more and more. We've actually seen a few physicians start running for office in an attempt to really take action around this issue, not here in Pittsburgh, but elsewhere in the country.
So, Christina, how do you plan on covering this issue in the future?
So this story is one of four in an ongoing series about cancer in southwestern Pennsylvania as it relates to pollution and industry. So I plan to continue monitoring the science and hearing from researchers and learning everything I can about this issue and educating my readers as I'm able.
Christina Marusik reports for the Environmental Health News. We'll have links to all her work on our website at WESA.FM. Christina, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the city approves an ordinance to grade 10 feet of Grants Hill downtown in 1836. The hill was between Diamond and 6th Streets and was cutting off growth to downtown Pittsburgh. So, developers gradually shaved off the hump until it was level with the surrounding streets. The project continued up until 1914 and cost a few million dollars, but most historians say the change was worth it, as it alleviated congestion and simplified travel. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In this last episode of Still Working, WESA series about life and labor in Western Pennsylvania, a retiree, a job seeker, and a volunteer. Three Western Pennsylvanians who don't get up and go to a job every day for very different reasons.
And then we have a new opossum because Peaches is in kind of semi-retirement. His name's Tater Tot. Hey, bud. Irwin. Yeah, Irwin, North American porcupine. Hi, Irwin. He's asleep.
My name is Mary Spraycar. I'm a volunteer here at the Wildlife Center. I've been here almost 10 years. I also volunteer at our domestic shelter with the cats, and I foster baby squirrels.
All right. So we take a few practice swings and, you know, choose the right club, look at the conditions. A little bit to the right.
My name is Demetrius Ellis. I'm a retired academic pediatric nephrology physician from the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine and Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh here at the Bob O'Connor Golf Course. Now I'm just about full-time golf enthusiast, so to speak.
So this is where it gets just a little bit gloomy. Like you're trying to write, you don't know what is the right word to write.
what to write or what to say. Then it also gets uncertain, like, you know, whether it's the right thing to do, how much you have to do. Because you can, I can try 100 jobs, 1,000 jobs, and then I just need one job. And yeah, I don't know these answers yet. My name is Shikha Goodwin, and I'm here today talking about what it has been like looking for a job and looking for a new work and vision and dreams for myself, and what I am really good for or what I would like to do. So I normally do upstairs. Right now there's stuff up and down. So welcome. So we have two rooms here. One is here, bedroom, and this is my office. It's work to look for work. It's really, really actually, and it's actually even harder to look for work than doing the work. Because when you're doing work, you have it all set. You have a routine, you have a place, you get meaning. But when you're looking for a job, there is a lot of emotions, vagueness, uncertainty, not knowing, and this constant doubt about yourself.
We're assigned something different every week. So you look on your daily agenda, you look and see what area you're assigned to. Today I'll be in what's called the menagerie, where our education animals are. We have an avian nursery, mammal nursery, rabbit room, runs, rehabilitation runs. Those are mostly for the raptors. Last year we took in over 4,000 animals. We take in anything injured, orphaned, native Pennsylvania wildlife, except poisonous snakes and deer. And the mission is just to, you know, to rehabilitate and get them back out into the wild to, you know, live their lives.
Like many other people contemplating retirement, I had thought about it, but I didn't really know how my day was going to go. I love to compete in many of the sports. And so I wanted to continue that, but I also wanted to maintain some mental acuity, because you have to exercise the brain separately from the rest of the body, so to speak. So now, golf, you have to choose the right club, look at the wind velocity, if it's cold or warm, is the ground wet, is the grass high? So all those decisions keep your mind more alert, but at the same time, you have to be physically competent. Otherwise, you can think all you want, nothing is going to happen out there, you know. So it takes practice and determination, and those are things that are ingrained in me.
So I have been trained as a scientist, as an engineer, as a clinician. I did brain research for 15 years, so I studied brain from inside and outside, and I love it. I wanted to see how exercise can change the structure and function of your brain, and how exercise can be used as an intervention for people with MS, multiple sclerosis. So that I did for 3 or 4 years. And last year, 1 year ago, I drove here. Right. My son is there watching me. Believing in all my dreams that I had had for 20 years, and my dreams were to help change the world by hopefully discovering something about the brain that no one in the world has before.
Oh yeah, I was a medical transcriptionist for about 42 years. You really have to concentrate, and you got paid by what you did. It was production by the line, so I mean, you really had to. And I was working an overnight shift, so that was a little hard too, like 10 at night till 6 or 6:30 in the morning. I was glad I was able. I took an early retirement, so I couldn't wait. Yeah, I was just like counting down the days until I got to when I could take my money out of my retirement account and knew I could, yeah.
We drove with our kids, my husband, me, and 2 kitties from Minnesota to Pittsburgh. And we thought this will be our dream city and we will live here, and will be here for a long, long time. And this is yet to be found out whether this will be. I joined Department of Psychiatry at University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And I learned very soon that everything happens for a reason. And professionally, I left my old job, and then I have been actively looking, super actively looking. My baby, my kids also know I'm suffering. So when Nina makes gifts for me, "Mommy, this gift is for you, I love you," and then she puts money in there. It's very adorable and cute, but it's inside representation of how much they know we are financially struggling, I think, and which I hate. I would never want them to know. But it's very cute. So in a couple of years, when everything will be over, then I think I'll laugh about it, that she used to give me 25 cents. I'm not even kidding, and there was 25 cents in it there.
I retired February 2017. I spent years on the road all my life, and this is the time I can choose when to go out. So my work involved a lot of emergencies and spending 14, 16-hour days at the hospital oftentimes, along with set times for clinics, for giving lectures to students and residents, and doing research and writing scientific papers. I was born in Greece. We lived under some very difficult circumstances. I was raised by a grandmother and mother who took care of me after my parents' divorce. And they're my heroes. And they definitely, especially my grandmother, with all the difficulties that she had financially and without much support, she put two of her children through college in Greece. So education has been certainly paramount in my own life. And I believe it's the, you know, a great equalizer out there.
I was taking care of my mother, and she passed away. And I had some, you know, more free time. And I thought, well, I want to volunteer. I want to do something. It's just probably, you know, something's in your nature. It's part of you, I guess, you know, to care. And I came to an information session and just thought, well, I think, I love animals. And this would really be something different. And it's turned out to be wonderful. It's, I think, one of the best things I've ever done. Hey, Ray, what do you say?
Squash! Squash!
Like squaw or squash. Yeah, he's learned. They mimic. You know, they've heard. Ah, somewhere along the line, he's been here for a good many years.
I was playing in the final of a tennis tournament, and I was in the second set when I developed severe tennis elbow. Because I was unable to play tennis, a neighbor introduced me to golf. So this gentleman gave me a couple clubs. He showed me what to do. I thought it was an extremely expensive sport for rich people who were very compulsive. And all my friends from soccer said, "This is not your temperament." And that even caused me to become more determined to learn it, because that, again, was my personality. Tell me something I can't do, and I will make sure I do it.
I was told I can never get a PhD. So here I have it, but that took away 1 year of my life. Like, so don't say you can't, just say, how can you? You need to dream. You need to dream big. And I think the purest of dreams are which are not for you. Because when it's truly ingrained in you that you want to help people, then it just happens. Like, you just find that those ways. So when I go back to my training of scientists, engineering, and clinician, actually those are three big circles in Venn diagram. In the center is helping people. Because that's something truly I want to do. I want to help people. And that's what drives me. And I want that help to be bigger than me and my family. Hey, you see all these people or all these successful, like, you're like, how did they get there? Or
Like, what was their break, or who believed in them?
Sports was not emphasized in our home, and nobody ever took me out to play. This was all self-induced. And so I felt that that self-esteem and having respect for yourself and understanding what's important in life can get you ahead no matter what background you come from. So we all need some help, though, from time to time. And having some mentors along the way has been very helpful.
Let me put your blanket in first, okay? Let's put your blanket in.
The animals that come in, they're patients. This is a wildlife hospital. And we don't, you know, we interact, like, you don't go ahead and hold them like you would like a kitten or anything like that. Obviously, you know, it's treatment and feeding and cleaning, medicine, hand feeding the squirrels. So they're not given any names. They have numbers, case numbers. It's like work, you know, because you have a commitment, you know. But I think it's more like I look forward to it, whereas my other job, there were times I really didn't. But I enjoyed it from the first time I came. You know, it's a little more physical work involved than some people realize. You try to tell them that, like it's scrubbing and cleaning and, you know, moving things around. And
you can't do everything in life. I used to feel guilty for not doing more, you know, and not doing it earlier. You can find a lot of stuff to feel guilty about, okay? But anything you do, pick one cause and just do it. If everybody did that, it would be tremendous, okay? You know, and not finding excuses, you know, there's always something that you can do, you know? Giving your time, if you have money, give your money. If you have skills to empower them, people, do that. Be a good mentor to somebody. I did that all my life. That was the biggest pleasure of my life, was teaching.
In my mind, I feel like it must be my fault. Like, I'm doing something wrong, right? Like, because you can't blame the environment or someone else. So you're just, I'm like, what can I change about myself? I'm like, okay, this time I'll do this right. So
it's very rewarding. You see an animal come in, especially these orphan little squirrels, little opossums, and then you can watch them, you know, they progress, and then they're released. So, I mean, it just really gives you it does boost your confidence, you know, when you're doing something. I mean, I would have never thought if someone said, you know, be able to feed bats, or you'll be able to tube feed a raccoon, you know, things like that. I would have never, you know, never thought I'd be able to do something like that, so.
Oh, this is, so I actually, every day I do the call, if it's okay. So she and I pray every day. She was my student actually a couple of years ago. Hello.
Hi.
Good morning, how are you?
Good.
Good. Should we pray?
Yeah.
I pray for myself, as Angela said, I believe in it, that you have the right job for me at the right place where I belong, and you will show me the right path, but in calmness. God, I surrender my process to you, that you will help me, calm me, and be there for me. God, I also pray for the other jobs I have in life, as a mother, as a friend, as a wife.
You see how the walk is nice, right? And clean air, grasses to look at, beautiful vistas, hopefully no rain. There's clouds here, it rained a short time ago, everything is wet, right? So the question is, how long can you play, right? And can you hear the birds? So one guy told me, if you hear the birds sing, don't worry about the rain. If they're out chirping, it means it's gonna be okay.
Still Working is produced by Margaret J. Krause and Kevin C. Brown, with support from the A.W. Mellon Educational and Charitable Trust Fund of the Pittsburgh Foundation. Stay with us. The producers of Still Working join us when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin, and I'm joined by the producers of Still Working. In studio is Margaret J. Krause. Hello, Margaret.
Hello, Kevin.
And on the line from California is Kevin C. Brown. Hello, Kevin.
Hi there, Kevin.
Great to talk with you. And so a reminder to our listeners, you too were inspired by historian, broadcaster, Pulitzer Prize winner Studs Terkel in his iconic working series, interviews with people talking about what they do. Was there an episode, a guest maybe, who surprised you and how so? Kevin, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the joys of doing this kind of reporting is that you often realize how little you know when you start talking to someone about their work, and realize that there's a lot of skill, knowledge, judgment in jobs that maybe you don't always think of as having, you know, a ton of authority or power, things like that. And so everything from bus drivers to movers to lawyers really came out for me in each of those kinds of interviews.
Margaret?
Yeah, I think I'm going to echo Kevin and just say, for me, each interview was a surprise. There was always some perspective that the person brought to their work or their day that I just found so poignant and lovely.
There were themes to each episode of Still Working, ranging from people who feed us to people who get us moving to those who don't exactly work 9 to 5. I'm going to ask you the mandatory question, Margaret. Any favorites? It's mandated.
It's in the rules. Oh man, that's so difficult. We talked to 40 people, 39 people. I loved the baseball player.
Altoona?
The Altoona Curve, Jonathan Schwind. It was our first episode. I loved the union janitor we talked with. God, I don't know. I'm having lots of emotions. I feel like every single one was my favorite because I got to look in people's eyes and be like, how do you feel about your life?
Kevin.
Well, you know, I won't equivocate as much as Margaret, though I share her sentiment.
Katie.
I'll say that the episode we did about streets involved three kinds of work. The people who make the street signs that we see around the city and the county, a person who runs a small hot dog cart, and a bus driver. And I think those are three really common services and icons that we interact with. But each of them had a really unique perspective on their work and its meaning that really helped me see those things in a new way. And I hope also communicated to listeners the same, that there is a story behind things that we often take for things and people's work that we often take for granted.
Briefly, a follow-up, Kevin. Did you find joy in the people about their work that you profiled?
You know, one of the things that Studs says in the intro to Working is that work is a search for meaning as well as daily bread. And I think that some people we talked to absolutely found joy in the things that they were doing. But I think there were other folks that we spoke to who really used their work as a way to find joy in some other part of their life. And so for at least a few of the people we spoke to, that was music, that their work enabled them to be creative somewhere else. And so in some sense had made their peace with that being a necessary part of their life to do this other thing. So I think to say that everyone finds joy is probably unrealistic and not accurate, but it's absolutely true that people always impressed me with the parts of their life that they had a passion for. Yeah.
Margaret, just a couple sentences. What do you hope the listeners glean from this project?
That every person represents their own universe. Every human being that you pass on the street or spend time with or come into contact with, positive or negative, that they have so much that they see and they feel, and that I hope people walk away feeling like they learned something about our region from hearing from these individuals, but also recognize that these people are special, but they also are not unique. Everyone, if given the chance, has something interesting to say.
If you missed this or previous episodes, their mid-month snacks, or just want more Still Working in your life, the full catalog is available online at wesa.fm/stillworking and wherever you get your podcasts. Margaret J. Krause and Kevin C. Brown are the producers of the WESA series Still Working that profiles Western Pennsylvanians through their work. Thanks so much to both of you for your great work.
Oh, thanks, Kevin.
Oh, thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Allegheny Land Trust is looking to preserve a 40-acre site that was formerly a coal mine in Bethel Park and Castle Shannon and protected from redevelopment. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.